Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. Dan Olson here on behalf of appellant Daniella Deering from the Bassford Remley Law Firm. Your Honors, as this court recognized in the Kiefer v. Provident Life and Accident Insurance Company case, this court must closely scrutinize dismissal imposed as a discovery sanction because, quote, the opportunity to be heard is a litigant's most precious right and should be sparingly denied. We're here today because the district court has abused its discretion by snatching this right from appellant Deering based on the various missteps of her counsel. And we respectfully request this court reverse the decision and several other related erroneous decisions for this reason. Now, turning first to the most pressing issue before this court, the district court abused its discretion in dismissing Ms. Deering's case on case-ending sanctions for two reasons. The first reason is, to the extent the district court issued the sanctions order pursuant to Rule 37b-2, doing so in the absence of a prior order to compel is a clear abuse of discretion. And this court has held the same and reached that same conclusion in the Fox v. Studebaker, v. Worthington case. But even if this court were to have considered the dismissal as the district court exercising its inherent authority, rather than pursuant to Rule 37b-2, the district court still abused its discretion. And this is because case law makes clear that in exercising inherent authority to dismiss a case on case-ending sanction, the court must first consider whether a less severe sanction would remedy the wrong. And this is not something that can be done in passing. The Comstock case notes that this must be a reasoned rejection.
What less severe sanction can you think of that would have addressed the magnitude of the misrepresentation here?
Well, I think there's no less than three less severe sanctions, Your Honor. I mean, first and foremost, we have a subsequent monetary sanction. The district court clearly saw its fit to impose nearly $100,000 sanction against an individual in this case, an individual that is not going to be relying on her attorneys to pay it, but is going to have to pay it out of her own pocket. The district court could have limited her wage loss claim to the point of the deposition in November 1st of 2021. That would have been a significant deterrent and meaningful punishment. And then, of course, the district court could have allowed Lockheed Martin to impeach Ms. Deering at trial until the cows come home with the earlier testimony to the extent they believed it to be inaccurate or false. So there was a host of less severe sanctions.
Say that second one again. Limit the wage loss claim. How?
They could have capped her wage loss claim as of the date of her deposition. That was a remedy.
How would that respond to the misconduct that was found?
Well, it would have limited her wage loss claim to about 50% of what it would have been otherwise had she been allowed to proceed to trial. But the point there being is this interaction, this discussion about whether a lesser sanction would have effectively resolved the issue is the first discussion that has occurred in this case. And it's a discussion that should have taken place at the district court level, but did not, because the district court just breezily concluded that any other sanction would be nothing more than a slap on the wrist.
Does it make a difference that the misrepresentation went for, or was went uncorrected, that the for 19 months, that somehow changes it to even being more serious? Because presumably Lockheed relied on that information that was provided in the deposition, later found out it was untrue, of course, but that came much later. And so does that change things, do you think, that it went uncorrected for such a long period of time during the litigation?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and I don't think that's the case for two reasons. First, as made clear in Ms. Deering's declaration, she was under the assumption that the Anaplan documents had been produced by prior counsel. So it wasn't until she realized in prepping for trial exhibits that 19-month period had elapsed. It was never her intention that those documents were going to go unproduced to counsel for the better part of a year and a half. And the second reason it doesn't make a difference, Your Honor, is the disclosure of those ANA plan documents and the subsequent reduction of her wage loss claim worked to the benefit of Lockheed Martin in this case. In other words, she compelled her counsel to produce documents that hurt her and helped her former employer. It's not something that prejudiced Lockheed Martin. It's something that benefited Lockheed Martin. Now, the second reason the district court would have abused
its... That's the fact that that we have an attorney involved here. Doesn't that elevate this to a significant extent?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. The district court didn't cite any specific case that would hold an attorney-client to a heightened level of ethics or responsibility. And certainly Lockheed hasn't cited any case to the same effect in either before the district court or here on appeal. So I don't think that should matter. There simply is no standard that the court can point to that would support the proposition that an attorney-client is held to heightened standards.
Although if she were counsel, there's a duty of candor to the court. And so at least counsel should, even in non-counsel situation where they're the client, they should know that the duty of candor to the court is extremely important.
I would agree with that, Your Honor, yes. And ultimately, she did adhere to that duty of candor when she discovered her client's missteps in late May, early June, prior to prepping for trial. Now, the second reason the district court abused its discretion is because there isn't a clear and convincing threshold showing of ill intent in this case.
Of what?
Of bad intent or ill intent. In opposition to the sanctions motion, Ms. Deering's counsel submitted not one, not two, but three declarations exonerating Ms. Deering's conduct in the failure to disclose produce the ANA plan documents. Moreover, Ms. Deering submitted a declaration arguing to the court as part of her request for reconsideration that it was at her insistence that these documents were produced and at her insistence alone. The difference between this conduct and the conduct that has led to case-ending sanctions in other cases before this jurisdiction is stark. Consider the Savola case. There, a plaintiff was repeatedly warned of the likelihood of dismissal if the plaintiff continued to fail to answer interrogatories, all while the court noted they possessed the information to do so. The Kiefer case is similarly instructive. There, the plaintiff had destroyed 1,000-plus date timer calendar entries that could have been used by the defendant insurance company to disprove his disability. And he was given an opportunity to recreate those deleted entries, but failed to do so. The Comstock case is similarly instructive. The plaintiff trustee failed to disclose a slew of medical records, and all of the and some of the expert accident reconstructionist test results. Considering those three cases, which involved repeated misconduct, repeated ignoring of the court's orders, and in some cases the destruction of evidence, the conduct here, especially in light of Ms. Deering's efforts to correct the wrong, simply does not reach the same threshold showing to support a case-ending sanction. So for those reasons, the district court clearly has abused its discretion in this case, and we'd request that the court reverse the sanctions order and remand for further proceedings. Now, I want to touch...
Oh, you've talked mostly about the document production, but wasn't there also a concern about the testimony?
Yes, there was.
The plaintiff?
There was concern about the testimony. The testimony that, as was explained by Ms. Deering in her declaration, was never properly in front of the court because the court denied improperly the continuance request of her counsel. Had the court had the benefit of granting that continuance request and reviewing Ms. Deering's declaration, it would have had the innocuous explanations on both points. With respect to Invent, her declaration makes clear that she was under the assumption that as of that date, November 1st, she was still considered an employee of Invent such that her benefits would continue through November until she started at Anaplan. With respect to the Anaplan testimony, she made clear that the issue wasn't that the issue kind of turned on whether she truly applied as of that time. And she hadn't applied as of that time. She had applied to Anaplan years earlier, which was produced in discovery. And it wasn't until it was part of the onboarding process that she applied. So could that testimony have been clearer? Yes.
Say that again? But she already had the job, and she was scheduled to start working there.
Correct. And she said, didn't formally fill out an application until part of the onboarding process.
So she, and they asked her, have you looked for any alternative employment while you've been working for EnVen? And she said, no.
Correct.
And you're saying even though she already had the job lined up at Anaplan, she had not looked for employment?
Her testimony, as set forth in her deposition, was that she was not looking for new employment with Anaplan at that time. Anaplan approached her about the opportunity, and that's how the opportunity came to pass. But the important thing to recognize, and I understand my time is getting short here, and I do want to turn to another issue, is the finding of bad intent on the part of Ms. Deering is irreconcilable with the fact that she ultimately compelled her counsel to produce the Anaplan documents, albeit on the eve of trial. If she truly meant and truly intended to hide that employment and secure her wage loss claim to the highest threshold that could have been, why would she have asked her counsel to produce the documents in the prior to trial? Because this is not a case, as is the case in the other cases I mentioned moments ago, where a plaintiff was caught doing something wrong. This is something that a plaintiff realized her counsel had screwed up and insisted that they correct it. So it is logically inconsistent to believe that she intended to lie during her deposition and yet subsequently forced the production of the documents that would have been discussed and available at the deposition had they been produced at that time.
And Lockheed wasn't aware, just one factual question, Lockheed was not aware that she had different employment before the decision to produce it happened?
Correct. Okay. Correct. And presumably would not have been aware but for Ms. Deering's compelled production.
How do you know that Lockheed didn't know or wouldn't have discovered?
I can't speak to how Lockheed would have discovered. I can speak to the representations they made in their briefing, such that the first time they learned of this was on the eve of trial. That was the impetus for the motion for case-ending sanctions. With no further questions, I'll respectfully reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you for your argument. Mr. Schmidt, we'll hear from you.
May it please the court, counsel, the district court, Judge Doty, properly and appropriately dismissed appellant's lawsuit based on her extensive discovery or litigation misconduct, including perjury at her deposition, false statements and submissions to the court, and discovery misconduct. Judge Doty's decision was not an abuse of discretion, and nothing appellant has said on appeal changes that fact, and therefore that decision should be affirmed. I'm going to address the sanctions issues, not deal with the substantive summary judgment issues, although, of course, if the court has questions about that, I'm happy to answer those. Now, as we consider the district court's decision on sanctions, of course, it's important to remember the standard of review, which is an abuse of discretion standard. And as we consider that standard of review, it's important to evaluate what the district court held and why the district court came to that conclusion. That's the only way you can analyze the order. An appellant's appeal falls apart when you consider what the district court's actual decision is, because the district court did not address merely a failure to produce documents, as appellant wants to argue on appeal. Instead, the district court focused on a litany of misconduct throughout the litigation, and that's why the district court dismissed the case. That misconduct falls into three basic areas, and I'll talk about each of them in turn. The first area deals with false statements at Ms. Deering's deposition. And those misstatements, those false statements under oath, fall into two groups. The first concerns her job search. She not only stated that she had not searched for a job, but she also stated quote, it is disheartening, unquote, to continue a job search when she is, quote, not getting anything, unquote. She gave that testimony weeks after she had just gotten another job that paid her substantially better than the job she had at nVent. And then the second type of misconduct concerned her false statements about her current employment. She not only testified that she was still employed at nVent, which she wasn't, but she embellished that testimony by talking about her current job title, her current job duties, and her current reporting relationships. Of course, she had worked her last day at nVent. She knew she had worked her last day at nVent. She wasn't being paid by nVent any longer. And then a month later, she filed an errata sheet in which she didn't change any of those answers. Now, appellant, in their briefing, doesn't address any of that. The first you heard from that on appeal was opposing counsel's oral argument in response to the questions of this court. And here, opposing counsel trots out some explanations that she tried to offer to the district court trying to explain that testimony. Those were considered by the district court. They're addressed by Judge Doty in his order, and he found those explanations not to be credible. He provides an explanation as to why they're not credible in his order, and it is not an abuse of discretion for him to come to that conclusion. Appellant doesn't address any of that in her briefing, and so she's just arguing the failure to produce documents. But if you look at the cases from this court that address the relevant conduct, which is false statements under oath, you find that this court has repeatedly held that such statements do justify the sanction of dismissal. And in particular, the Martin v. Daimler Chrysler and the Chrysler Corp v. Carey cases are both on point. In the Martin case, this court held that false statements about prior medical treatment and prior lawsuits were appropriate bases for a dismissal of claims and a monetary sanction on top of it. And in the Chrysler Corp case, the court held that a failure to produce documents and false statements about the production of those documents were sufficient to justify the sanction of dismissal. Notably, this court in that case actually considered the Rule 37 argument that's raised by counsel here today and said that the appellant in that case was trying to mischaracterize what the district court concluded and trying to characterize it as only a failure to produce case, exactly as appellant tries to do here, and tries to argue that there'd been no Rule 37 order, exactly as appellant does here, and rejected those arguments because it wasn't just a failure to produce case. Instead, there were false statements, and those false statements justified the sanction of dismissal.
What do you do with the fact that this case is a little unusual in that we have a couple of attorneys that have sort of fallen on the sword and said, well, actually, it's my fault. Please don't hold it against, paraphrasing, Don't hold it against my client. What do we do with that?
That's a great question, Your Honor, and the answer is that this court and the Supreme Court have both held that sanctions are still appropriate. The Supreme Court in the Link case, this court in the Bogertz case, both of which are cited in our materials. The Bogertz case, I think, is particularly instructive because in that case, all of the misconduct was by counsel. And counsel actually made statements that without client authorization, and this court still held that was a dismissal was an appropriate sanction. And notably, the court references the American system of justice in which parties are responsible for the conduct of their counsel. In this case, of course, even if you go beyond that, so that's the legal answer, from a factual standpoint, it's quite clear that it's not just the attorneys, right? Maybe the attorneys are responsible for the production of documents. I mean, Judge Doty found that was not the case, and I think he was right to do so. But it was the appellant who testified falsely under oath at her deposition. It was appellant who failed to correct that with the errata sheet. It was appellant who submitted a declaration to the court in which she attached a false resume, that's a false statement under oath to the court, and it was appellant who failed to execute answers to interrogatories that contained her employment. That's all her conduct. So factually speaking, it isn't just the attorneys falling on the sword, it is the party who engaged in the misconduct. Which is a great segue into the second type of misconduct, which are false statements made to the court. I just alluded to one of them, which was the false affidavit submitted to the court, which was signed by Deering, not by her lawyer. But also, there were the settlement letters, two of them submitted to the court, which made false statements to the magistrate judge, and there were false damages computations submitted to the court. All of those threaten the integrity of our judicial system because we have a party making false statements to the court. And all of that misconduct also justifies the sanction of dismissal. Appellant doesn't talk about any of that in her briefing and doesn't explain why that independently doesn't justify sanctions. So even if there was no discovery misconduct, those are two areas of misconduct that would independently justify the dismissal of sanctions. This court has held that that type of conduct in the Martin case and in the Chrysler case, both two cases from this court holding that type of conduct is enough to justify the sanction of dismissal. Certainly, it is not an abuse of discretion to come to that conclusion. But let's talk about the discovery misconduct because that's what counsel talked about in his argument. And so the story now is that appellant wanted to disclose these documents, and it was her counsel who failed to disclose these documents, and she is blameless because she ensured that those documents were produced at trial. There are four problems with this argument, one of which I've already articulated in response to your question, Your Honor, which is our system our legal system says that the party is responsible for counsel's conduct. But beyond that, the second problem with that argument is you have to consider it in light of the overall picture, which is how Judge Doty considered it when he evaluated this argument, which, of course, was presented to the district court. And Judge Doty found that that explanation rang hollow in light of the overall type of misconduct, because all of this concerns the same predicate set of facts. When you have a party who testifies falsely about her job search at her deposition, testifies falsely about her current job at her deposition, submits an affidavit to the court falsely representing her current employment, submits not one but two settlement letters telling the court that she was still employed at EnVent, and provides damages calculations in which she says she was employed at EnVent, and says in her interrogatories that she's not employed at Anaplan, and then comes to the court and says, it's not my fault, it's my counsel's fault. The district court properly held that that explanation was not worthy of credence. And it is not, absolutely not, an abuse of discretion for the district court to come to that conclusion. Judge Doty exercised his discretion, and he did so correctly in my view. The third problem with her argument is that her explanation about this disclosure is incorrect. She claims that she discovered at the last minute that, this hadn't been disclosed. And so out of the goodness of her heart, she disclosed the information on the eve of trial. Au contraire, the context was actually Lockheed Martin brought a motion to limit her damages because she had failed to provide updated mitigation information. Now at that point, the updated mitigation information was the Anaplan employment documents. And she was staring down a motion to exclude all of her future wage damages on the eve of trial. That was the context in which she produced this information, not out of the goodness of her heart, but because she knew that she might lose her ability to testify about future wage loss at her trial. And then finally, the fourth problem.
Wait, before you go to the fourth
Your Honor.
Problem, are you saying that Lockheed filed the motion because they knew about the Anaplan? No, they just wanted an update generically.
That's right.
But you're saying that would have raised a concern by the plaintiff that I need to disclose now?
Well, we asked the court to exclude all of her future wage loss damages because she had failed to update her mitigation.
I see.
So of course, I don't know how.
So you're thinking she had to update in some way and decided to update with the Anaplan?
Right. Well, she had to. I mean, that was where she was employed. So if she was going to produce information about her subsequent wages, that's what the information was.
Go ahead to your fourth.
Yeah. So my last point is that she didn't actually produce the relevant information. What she actually did, and Judge Doty discusses this in his order, what she actually did was in her trial exhibits, she snuck in some trial exhibits that contained Anaplan information, which were not Bates numbered. Now, of course, you know that any document that was produced in discovery was Bates numbered. Well, the Anaplan documents, not having been produced in discovery, were not Bates' number. So this was not a situation in which she came clean, called counsel, said, hey, I have this information, I'm going to produce all my Anaplan documents. Now, I want to address the two arguments that counsel raised as to why Judge Doty abused his discretion. And the first argument was this Rule 37 argument that there wasn't a prior Rule 37 order. Of course, there's two problems with that argument. The first problem with the argument is that it assumes that this is a failure to produce situation, which it isn't really. It's not that she failed to produce the Anaplan documents, it's that she made false statements to the counsel, to the opposing party and to the court about it. So there isn't, it isn't a, you know, an order to produce, right? There's a whole set of sanctions cases that say you failed to produce documents, we order you to produce documents, you ignore the court's order. That's the situation that they're trying to shoehorn this into, but that's not the case. This case is about false statements made to the court. The second problem with, of course, is that this court's directly rejected it. I mean, that's the Chrysler case, where the party in that case also tried to argue, hey, there's no Rule 37 order, and this court said, you're trying to mischaracterize the district court's decision. And instead, it's appropriate to dismiss. And then the last argument that they make is the less severe sanctions argument. And
why do you think the judge cited Rule 37 then?
I think he was just being complete, Your Honor. The parties did.
You don't think that was really the basis for the order?
No, I don't, Your Honor.
All right. Go ahead.
The second argument is the less severe sanctions argument, and the problem with that argument is that the district court unquestionably did consider less severe sanctions. I'm just going to quote from page 10 of the court's order because it disposes of this argument. Quote, the court recognizes that dismissal is an extreme sanction to be used sparingly, but it is appropriate under these circumstances. And the court goes on. It shows that her conduct was intentional, willful, and in bad faith. After some citations, the court continues. A lesser sanction would provide no more than a slap on the wrist. The court is tasked with punishing the misconduct and deterring such behavior in the future. Given the gravity of Deering's misconduct and the fact that it was ongoing throughout most of this litigation, a lighter sanction will simply not suffice. The court takes no pleasure in coming to this conclusion, but it must do so given the facts. The court not only says it considers less severe sanctions, but then it explains why those sanctions would be insufficient, because they would not deter future misconduct, because the conduct was willful, and because the conduct was ongoing throughout the litigation. Now, Deering is reduced to arguing on appeal what he didn't specify what less severe sanctions he considered. I am aware of no decision from this court or any other court saying that Judge Doty had to identify what less severe sanctions he had to consider. He just had to say he considered them and explain why they were insufficient, which he did. Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate your attention.
All right. Thank you for your argument. Mr. Olson, we'll hear rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to take the last point first, which is there are two cases that we cited to in our brief and that I discussed during my primary argument that stand for the proposition that the district court's reasoning of a lesser sanction in this case amounts to an abuse of discretion. The Comstock case notes expressly that it must be a reasoned rejection. That reasoned rejection language implies that it must be done something in furtherance than just rejecting in passing as what the district court considered would be nothing more than a slight slap on the wrist. The second case that I discussed earlier holds the same notion, the Ganghorn case, that the court had a similar sanctions order in front of it, as is the one here, and the court noted that there was no way for the court to understand what the district court had actually considered in lesser sanctions because the analysis was so sparse. That Ganghorn case And the Comstock case, I would point the court to and urge the court to follow suit here.
But here, isn't it a little different? Because we have a district court who made almost, they were almost like sentencing findings. I mean, the district court talked about the willfulness of the behavior, the longstanding nature of the behavior, and then went on and said, granted, didn't talk about what those lesser sanctions were, but explained why he wasn't going to grant any lesser sanctions because it wouldn't deter violations like this.
No, Your Honor, and here's why. If the district court was issuing the case-ending sanctions order pursuant to Rule 37b-2, those willfulness findings would excuse it from considering lesser sanctions, but not in the absence of a prior order to compel. So we already know 37b-2 was impermissible in this case. So what the district court is left with is that inherent authority to issue case-ending sanctions, and the case law in this circuit makes crystal clear that in order to exercise your inherent authority, you must have that reasoned rejection of lesser sanctions, which is not the case here. And finally, and in closing, this is a really important case in this jurisdiction. If upheld, we have case law issuing the ultimate sanction for a party insisting on correcting its counsel's mistakes. The effect of that would be catastrophic, creating a situation where if a client learns of an attorney's mistake, there is an immediate and irreconcilable conflict between the party and the attorney. The subsequent effect could be a dispute about whether or not to do what is right, which is to supplement the documents.
Well, whether the sanction is dismissal or monetary sanctions or some other sanction, what you say would be true, wouldn't it?
True, but not in the parameters of a case-ending sanction. This is, the case law makes clear, it's the ultimate right of a party is to come to court and to obtain justice as a jury sees fit. And if the court affirms this, Judge Doty's ruling, we have really, really dangerous precedent for the practice of law in this jurisdiction. It should not be the law in this jurisdiction, and I would submit that it cannot be the law in this jurisdiction. Thank you very much for your time.
Now, how would that affect the practice of law? I thought your concern was about the client.
It's about both, Your Honor. It's about the client in this particular instance, but it's about all of us, opposing counsel included, were this precedent to be upheld, or were this court to affirm the case and establish this as precedent.
Okay. Thank you for your argument.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you to both counsel. The case is submitted, and the court will file a decision in due course. That concludes the argument session for this morning. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow.